Hello, everyone, and welcome to Australian Sci-Fi, the Wheeler Centre panel. I'm Doug Hendry. I'm a non-fiction author with no right necessarily to talk about sci-fi, but my interest has primarily been on charting emergent futures, sort of the crazy South Korean video gaming, you know, professional video gaming scene and so on. So it was kind of natural for me to want to explore the science fiction subculture and the enormous creativity and also the splintering and the bifurcation that's taking place there. So I'm coming at this from a position of really deep curiosity about the sci-fi and also the broader speculative fiction scene, about the popularity of dystopias and also particularly what you're here to ponder as well. Does Australian sci-fi exist, or are there simply many Australians who write sci-fi? So we're talking at a time when science fiction's become a really increasingly broad church. So at the one end of the spectrum, we have the really hard science fiction from the likes of Perth's Greg Egan, where fiction is a way to play out weird science. But we have at the other end, pan-term speculative fiction popularised in the 40s by Robert Heinlein to describe literary fiction with fantastical or scientific elements. It seemed to me that the main point of departure is the role of science, whether we prioritise science or whether we use that as the backdrop through which our characters move. And it's also interesting to note, and I think we'll explore this on our panel, the fact that a great many literary fiction authors got their start in speculative or scientific fiction, or science fiction, from Peter Carey to Jonathan Franzen, and the list goes on. So to help us wrestle with these questions of genre and the Australian sci-fi identity, we have a really excellent panel of Australian sci-fi and speculative fiction writers, as you might expect. So to begin with, on my left, we have with us the chameleon writer Lucy Sussex, who has turned her talent to everything from neo-Victorian drama, pacts with the devil in Mesopotamia, fantasy, sci-fi, broader speculative fiction, as well as detective fiction and true crime. Not only this, but Lucy inhabits an alternate life as a researcher of 19th century literature and Australiana, and her most recent book is Thief of Lives, published last year.
Pleased to be here.
Please welcome Lucy. Next along we have Max Berry, who began his career by satirising a near-future Coca-Cola and syrup, then gave corporations near-total power over the state in Jennifer Government's corporate dystopia, and then in his most recent book, he weaponised neuro-linguistic programming his latest cerebral thriller, Lexicon, offering a future where trained poets use words to command weaker minds. And please welcome Max.
Thank you.
Next along, we have Jane Rawson, whose fabulous first book, A Wrong Turn at the Office of Unmade Lists, was released last year. Rawson's given us a lucky country whose luck has run out, mixed with UN peacekeepers in Melbourne and a between place where suspended imaginings offer a passage between worlds. So please welcome Jane. And finally, we have Andrew McRae, who grew up listening to the B-doubles roaring up the Great Dividing Range and through his home streets of Toowoomba. He's since fled and arrived here in Melbourne. But obsessed with trucking movies from the 70s in particular, he's given us, in Truck Song, a wholly new Australian dystopia, and one in which the end of AI-driven Geiger cities has spawned intelligent truck gangs, emerging robot flesh ecosystems, and canny survivalist humans. So we have four writers. We have four writers, all Australian and all, at times, writers of books containing both fiction and science in varying degrees, and a future yet to be born. So to begin with, I just wanted to ask each of our panellists a question before opening to a broader panel discussion and ending with 15 minutes of audience questions at the end. So we'll be delighted to field as many of your questions as we have time for. So to begin with, Lucy, I would really love to know how it is that you relate to genre, given that you have your career spans so many different genres.
Oh, well, you could say that life is a series of intersecting genres. and certainly my life's been that. But if you think of various types of writing, you can say that literary fiction is a genre itself. And it, so like crime fiction, like science fiction, like fantasy fiction. And all of them have a continuum within them, from the pulp to the to the very artistic. So on different genres come into prominence at different times and or get better or decrease in influence, like the Western. And if I get an idea, I just see what genre would suit it best. If it's a crime fiction idea, then I'll do crime. If it's a story about the devil in Mesopotamia, then I'll go and research ancient Mesopotamia. It's just where the idea comes from and where I situate it.
Fantastic. Thank you. And Max, in much of your work, you present American corporations as the most likely culprits for producing the dystopia we all kind of dread, but maybe perhaps secretly crave. Why is it that corporations are so often your go-to for presenting these sort of evil futuristic bodies?
Because they are, I guess. it's pretty easy to look around and see how much of our world is shaped by corporations. Yeah, I don't really have anything against corporations. I don't want to come off like, you know, a Stalinist or anything like that. But I just think that, given the opportunity, most corporations would probably kill us all for profit. But, you know, that's nothing against them. That's just how they're set up. You know, they would do that very efficiently and properly because that's what they're supposed to do. Our culture is so shaped by corporations. I did a marketing degree, so I went through and I learned all of the... Yeah. Thank you, Lucy. I was learning all these techniques for how to... not exactly lie to people, but how to create a perception in people's minds that makes them buy your product, regardless of how related it is to the truth. So I saw the way that there's a whole bunch of storytelling that is done by corporations. And so that's the world we live in, this world that is shaped and told to us by corporations. So, I tend to go there a little bit. I just find them interesting.
Fantastic. Thank you. And Jane, what I really enjoyed about your book was the playful touches. So it didn't really take much to imagine a fallen Melbourne's laneway bars as speakeasies, you know, Melburnians as grog smugglers and sleeping rough by the side of the Maribyrnong. It kind of felt as if the Great Depression had come around again. I suppose for a new dystopia, what I felt was unusual about it was its sense of humour. Normally they're kind of grim and a bit, you know, Cormac McCarthy or The Road or something like that. How did it come to be that you had a playful dystopia?
I think it's everything I do, essentially. I'm a really pessimistic person, and yet I find most things hilarious. So
I think I get that.
Yeah. It was kind of unavoidable for me. And I think writing jokes sort of propels my writing along. It makes me feel better about writing. Writing can be a little, you know, depressing sometimes. You're there by yourself going, am I any good at this? This is terrible. But if you can cheer yourself up with a few jokes along the way, that's good. And I think most people enjoy reading jokes. You know, Douglas Adams is quite funny and people have enjoyed reading him previously.
They
tell a few jokes yourself in your books.
Occasionally.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I think the world is made up of sad things and funny things and angry things, and you might as well include them all. So.
Fantastic. Thank you. And Andrew, what led you to trucking culture as a way to give us a new post-apocalyptic view of Australia?
I grew up in Toowoomba, and Australia really is the land of the last of the V8 interceptors. You know, I grew up in the 1970s and 1980s with in a regional town where Tiranas were up on blocks outside the front of the houses.
As they should be.
As all good Tiranas should be. I guess also coming at it from the angle of 1970s trucking movies as well, like it's this really cheesy genre of Western almost, where you get the lone ethical operator in a corrupt world, the independent truck driver ranging against the forces of the corrupt police on the one hand and the evil corporations on the other. Trucks for me became this kind of ideal metaphor for the apocalypse.
I can't believe no one got there first.
No, I know. It's bizarre, isn't it? AI trucks. Yeah. Why aren't there more?
Yeah. There are some really... for those who haven't come across it, there are some quite unusual romance scenes, I suppose, between AI trucks, which just, blew my tiny mind anyway.
Trucks also like sex.
Maybe I'll move on from there. All right. So now to throw out to the panel... The big one, okay. How do you relate to science fiction? Anyone like to go first?
Oh, yeah, go, Lucy. Yeah, hit it.
I suppose it's the area in which I was a depressed teenager in Townsville, North Queensland, and the only thing I wanted to read was science fiction because the world was going to come to an end, and it was sort of really satisfying to find out that the universe was going to be J.G. Ballard's The Voices of Time, that the universe was going to, the heat death of the universe would happen. This was great. So it gave me a deep taste for apocalyptic futures and dark goings-on. And although I haven't got a science degree, there's no reason why you can't write science fiction if you're a humanities person. All you do is you get a subscription to The New Scientist. And you just pick out the really good ideas from it that turn up every week. And the new things in technology, and you go, oh, wow. And it's such a fertile area in which to work, and there's so much going on, and there's so many alternate futures, new inventions, wonderful Paleolithic discoveries. I mean, you know, just a few years ago, we all discovered we're part Neanderthal. You know, wow. And it's that sense of wow that I really relate to, and that sort of keeps me with one foot still in science fiction.
Yeah, we really start out with science fiction and fantasy. Like, when you're reading as a kid, it's all science fiction, really, isn't it? Like, even if you go back to books with talking animals, it's, you know, the books that are about normal people living normal lives don't really come until they're forced on you by English teachers in high school. It's, you know, until then, you're reading about space battles and, you know, Stephen King and all that. That's certainly how I got started, reading a whole lot of science fiction and fantasy. And I probably don't read nearly as much as I used to, but that was certainly where I started. And it's just that natural, I guess, extension of the question, what if, which is where all stories come from. You know, what if this was like this? There's no hard line at which the point at which you go from a story that isn't science fiction into one that is, because they're all just what if stories that are stretched a little bit further than others. And certainly for me as a writer, I never set out to write a sci-fi book. I just write a book and realise at some point that it probably is science fiction.
Yeah, pretty similar for me. And I think to what you were saying about the sorts of books that you read when you're little are fantastical, and amazing things happen all the time, and there's so much potential for just fantastic stuff to happen to you in every corner of the world. And then that kind of shuts down, and you're like, this is how the world's meant to operate. This is how your life is supposed to be. Please try and just follow along that. And I've always struggled with that a little bit, I think. I'm always hoping there'll be something weird just around that corner, or, you know, behind that train track or whatever. And that's what's led me into the sort of writing I like to do, I think, which is, yeah, exploring what if. What if there was something weird there, then what? And then what if that, then what? Yeah, just a sort of dissatisfaction, I guess, with reality.
Yes, I can definitely relate to that dissatisfaction with reality. It just doesn't seem like the future we were promised in the science fiction of our childhood. There's an interesting comment in Damien Broderick's book, Reading by Starlight, which is like an academic book on science fiction, and he talks about the imprinting process of science fiction. Like, as kids, we're imprinted with... Or people who go on to become science fiction readers are imprinted with this kind of primal science fiction experience. And if you miss that boat, like if you miss out on being imprinted with the science fiction and fantasy mode as a child, it can be quite mysterious to people coming at it later in life. And for me, that imprinting moment, I was thinking about this the other day, was my very first cinematic experience. My mum took me to see Storm Boy in 1977, the Toowoomba Strand. And the preview coming attraction was Star Wars. So I'm 6 years old, I'm sitting in a darkened room, and the very first kind of giant image I see is the Star Wars aesthetic, the Star Wars universe. And I was hooked from then on, and just read everything I could get my hands on. But I was very definitely imprinted with that science fiction mode early on.
I'd say that it's very hard to get away from science fiction in that it's all pervasive. It's in advertising, it's in so many tropes that you can't avoid having a basic knowledge, even if you're only an occasional reviewer, a watcher of Star Trek or Star Wars or any of that. you know what the tropes are, and you know about faster than light travel and time travel and Doctor Who and all the rest of it.
Hmm. Actually, for this panel, I went back and had a look at my recent reading list, and I had the feeling that I hadn't read much science fiction for a long time, but when I went back and looked at what I'd been reading, there were all these books like The Time Traveller's Wife that are, you know, not space operas or anything, but are clearly science fiction, got time travel in it. They're very personal stories, and, you know, that's what I love about science fiction now, as opposed to when I was a bit younger. I'm less interested in the big ideas and more in how the small ideas can affect people very intensely. So that's the interesting thing about sci-fi for me now. But, yeah, there are a lot of books like that, and I don't think the average reader, as opposed to the more dedicated sci-fi fan, goes looking for a sci-fi book. You know, they hear about a book and it has a sci-fi idea in it. They don't necessarily even register it as a sci-fi novel, but it's an intriguing idea. They're open to it, but they're not necessarily looking for the genre. Mm.
That leads me to a question. Something I'm personally curious about is to whether or not literary fiction is infiltrating or borrowing increasingly from science fiction, so borrowing from that stock of ideas and doing so as a way to sort of go for a mass market. So it does seem like books like Time Traveler's Wife and people like David Mitchell, for instance, are sort of really borrowing those speculative sort of elements to it. Do you agree with that, do you think? Or?
Well, I don't know. I think that way back, you know, when H.G. Wells, the 19th century, there was no clear distinction. You just wrote fiction. You didn't have right science fiction, and so he did The War of the Worlds and The Time Traveller. And there were any number of utopias produced in Melbourne and Australia in the 19th century, you know, about the yellow peril or what would happen if we had socialism in Melbourne or if we went and destroyed the banks. I mean, really fun stuff like that. But there wasn't a clear distinction. And that really only arose with pulp fiction magazines in the 20th century. And I think we're getting back to it, getting back to that idea now that you don't actually have to stick in the one area of fiction, that you can grab the ideas that you want. But there are some differences of approaches. Like a really hard science fiction writer would insist that everything has to be scientifically accurate, or would make their imagined world internally consistent, and other people would riff off on much more impressionistic notions. It's really getting very hard to separate where people come from and when they decide to play with these tropes. And that's what it is. It's about play. It's about exploring interesting ideas, and I think that's possibly the attraction increasingly for literary writers, but I'll pass on to the rest.
Yeah, so just responding to that point, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm sure you read much more widely in this area than I do, but I have the impression that with Australian science fiction, we have, at either end of the spectrum, we have very literary science fiction, like probably Stephen Amsterdam's Things We Didn't See Coming, you know, successes like that that are on the literary end of it. And then we have more accessible science fiction, I guess you'd put it, more popular science fiction, but we don't have anything in the middle, which is the stuff that becomes much more popular overseas, where a book like The Time Traveller's Wife or Cloud Atlas is too literary. But these books that are about people and happen to have a science fiction idea in the heart of them. And you know, where is that in Australia? That's the part that seems missing as far as I can tell.
Oh, it's mainly in small presses and doesn't get the same degree of publicity. Stephen Amsterdam is, I think, currently in Patagonia, but his book was critiqued by science fiction writers within a group, and he could have gone either way. He happens to go to a small literary press, and he has the great good luck to win the Age Book of the Year. And because of that, that becomes a literary book. But there's plenty of small press activity that doesn't get the same attention, and it is literary. It's just a question of how much publishers are putting into science fiction and how much resources. And it's just the luck of the draw at the moment that the money is in fantasy. And so publishers are tending to put more attention, at least the mainstream. You know, you'd agree with me, Andrew, that HarperCollins, Penguin and the rest are putting more money into fantasy because that's where the money is.
got five writers on a panel here. We're all going to agree the publishers are doing it all wrong.
Oh, yeah, well, it's always fun to, criticise the publisher.
Unless they're there.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, there isn't a lot of strength in Australian science fiction as such. Like, a lot of Australian speculative fiction writers cross genres. I can't really, since Greg Egan, I can't really think of another
hard
yeah. Australian science fiction writer. I mean, I guess the point I'd like to make on that issue of that sort of slipstream mainstream writers who use science fiction tropes is that I guess I come at things more from a genre angle where I see genre as this conversation, like this intergenerational conversation. So Lucy mentioned H.G. Wells earlier, like he's kind of one of the founders of the genre. His book, First Men on the Moon, he conceived the cosmos as this cold, dark, empty place, devoid of life, which it actually is. And C.S. Lewis, who was a Christian, came along and wrote a response to that, basically Out of the Silent Planet, where he, as a Christian, he filled his cosmos with warmth and light and the Holy Spirit. So I guess that's just an example of that kind of genre conversation. And I guess maybe that might be one of the things that that writers who use genre tropes without necessarily being aware of the wider conversation around them might miss out on. I don't know, Jane, what do you think? We've sort of had this conversation.
This is something we were chatting about, but I think The Time Traveller's Wife is perhaps a good example of that, because I think that if you are a literary or a popular writer and you pick up some of those things and reproduce them, there's a pretty good chance that serious sci-fi readers who do understand all that are never going to read your book anyway.
I don't know about that. Science fiction fans read very widely. Yeah. And they're very vocal in their opinions.
Yeah. As we may find out shortly.
And yet people still bought The Time Traveller's Wife. Mm. So, you know, I think there are whole parts of the audience who aren't as sensitive, I guess, to the technical perfection of a science fiction style book as other parts of it, who care more about the characters and how they get on in that situation and are willing to let slide, you know, holes in the science or the time travel or whatever.
Okay, oh, fabulous. And just coming more towards the Australian experience, I was just wondering how it is that local landscapes, language and people shape your writing, whether you make deliberate choices to include them or to aim more potentially for an international type of audience. To what extent does that colour your writing or flavour your writing?
Well, I made a very conscious choice to write a very Australian book. Mm-hmm. I've gone full ochre in my work.
Durries features a lot.
Durries... I really wanted to try and capture the Australian colloquial vernacular.
Which seemed very well suited to After the Apocalypse.
Yes, well, it is. Again, Tirana's up on blocks, you know. it's a wonderful fit. I was thinking about Australia as kind of the ideal place to set the post-apocalypse or... Because for all intents and purposes, Australia skipped industrial modernity and went straight to post-industrial, post-modernism. Culturally, we're kind of... we live in the big cities on the coastal fringe, dominated by the knowledge economy, which brings with it biotech industries and advanced manufacturing and all of the things that come along with that. At the same time, there's also this tension with the fact that the economy is largely resources based. There's this massive kind of outback, you know, the outback, the figure of the outback, which is looms large in Australian literature. As this, you know, it's been figured in various ways, but it's this vacant for white people anyway. It's this vacant place where people disappear, you know. Mm. So yeah, I think there's that tension. Australia is the place where the desert of the real meets the real of the desert.
I'd say that it's actually almost an advantage to be Australian because you're slightly different. Australian writers do have a fairly high reputation internationally within science fiction and fantasy. They're well regarded. They've Margot Lanigan's won the World Fantasy Award, for instance, several times. And I think you bring something different to the conversation. For instance, I was asked to contribute to an anthology on song, and I thought, how can I stand out? And what can I write a song about? You know, how can I write a story about a song that the American authors, American editors will know? And I thought, hold on, they probably know Waltzing Matilda. They'll know the tune, if not the words, so I'll write a story about Waltzing Matilda. So I go and have a look at the lyrics of Waltzing Matilda, and I go, I don't believe a word of this. This is ridiculous. So I totally deconstruct the story of Waltzing Matilda and have an immense amount of fun, send it in, and the American publisher goes, oh, yes, great, you know, fine. So I think it is an advantage in that you're slightly different. But then, on the other hand, if you are writing about the far future like Greg Egan does, then Australian accents would vanish because we really can't say what's going to billions of years in the future. You know, Australia may well be part of India by that stage. We sort of rammed up into the continental drift.
Yeah. Yeah, for me it was. I mean, this is a question I wrestle with every book because I mostly accidentally got published overseas before I was published in Australia. When I say mostly accidentally, I'm really saying that publishers in Australia completely rejected me while publishers overseas did not. So I wound up with this first novel that was published in the United States and had an American readership. And ever since then, I've always had to think with each new book, how is this going to read to an American reader? So it's I've written a book that was set in Australia, but a near future Australia or an alternate present Australia that is part of the United States where all corporations are running the place in. I've done one that's set nowhere in particular, set in a Western city that isn't quite named. And the latest one that's set partly in Australia and partly overseas and has an American character who comes to Australia and so let me tell a story set in Australia but without completely bewildering an American reader. So it's a bit of a strange situation where I didn't quite plan to be doing this, but I'm very aware of the fact that I live in Australia and I want to tell stories about the things that I see and about the things that I know, but I have to try to find a way to make that internationally accessible, I guess. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, look, the things that Australian writers do well, we do humour really well. I think we have a really good blend of the American and the British sensibilities where the Americans are massive on plot and they're great on plot. And the Brits tend to be much bigger on character and I don't know if tone's the right word, but certainly that humour and that style they bring to it. So I think Australians often get a bit of both and mix it together and add a little bit of their own special something as well. So even when I'm writing a book that isn't set in Australia, I feel that's what I'm bringing to it.
Fantastic.
I guess in some ways my experience is similar, except that when I was writing my novel, I really had no idea it would be published. I mean, you know, I dreamt it would be a bestseller, obviously, but I had no realistic concept of it being published. So I had no idea in my head of who might read this, what does it need to be like. And it is set partly in Australia, partly in the US. But for me, I think it's mainly that idea that, I feel like I can only write as an Australian. Wherever the story is, my voice feels to me very Australian. And the kind of jokes I make probably wouldn't fly in other places. They just wouldn't make sense. And the sorts of words that I'm interested to use and play around with are very Australian. I don't feel like I could ever adopt the sort of cool international voice, I guess. I don't know how you do that.
There's a cool international
voice? That sort of namely voice.
Actually, that's a really interesting point, Jane, because as I was reading both your books, I thought, like your... I mean, your book couldn't have been written anywhere else other than Australia. You bring this kind of Southeast Asian influence to this post-apocalyptic climate changed Melbourne. It's kind of like Phnom Penh on steroids.
That's kind of actually what it was. Yes.
And I mean, I think Australia's a really unique position from which to be able to do that. Geographically, and then I think also Max, your book. because you're able to kind of tap into that kind of global zeitgeist, Australia affords both of those positions. Like you can tap into that international audience because of Australia's cultural location, I guess.
And our neutrality, I guess, in a way too.
There's also the tourism factor. People love reading about the sort of the Australian landscape, particularly the French. But Australians are receptive to different ideas. Like we go to the States, and people sometimes have trouble with our cute, your cute little accent. But we're used to these accents, and so we can write American, we can write English, and increasingly we can sort of pick up on Asian factors. And it means that the audience is wider, and we're quite cosmopolitan in our fiction. Whereas I think other cultures, it's not quite the same in that we're outside looking because we're in the middle of nowhere, and an empty continent, and so we have to engage with other readerships if we're going to survive as writers.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a really important point. Actually, the fact that Australia is tiny, and if you're first of all, if you're an Australian, you're really aware of the fact that there are a whole bunch of other countries out there. In a way that a reader in the United States and even the United Kingdom is not quite as aware, because there is so much in their own country. We get so many cultural influences from other places. And secondly, as a writer, you're exactly right. It's really hard to make a living as a writer just selling books in Australia, just selling novels in Australia. It's almost impossible. So if you are looking to make a career out of this, then being able to sell books in the UK and the US is massive. It helps you so much.
Mm. Lucy, it just sounded like you were actually inverting cultural cringe then to make it a selling point. You know, the outward looking, and not quite sure of our national identity can actually lend itself to mimicry. Or that's not sounding so great for Australia, but it actually lends itself to ability to take on other voices and points of view.
Yeah, it's quite easily. I mean, the cultural cringe was a huge factor in Australia. You used to get particularly Australians would go to England and then spend their whole time trying to write like the English and be like the English. Then, but that situation has changed now. There is an interest in Australia that in some quite unexpected places, and it can be a real advantage in that you've got a different voice and you've got a different sensibility.
Mm, great. Thank you. Now, I was just wondering whether you feel that Australian sci-fi and speculative fiction, more broadly, tend towards dystopia or apocalypse and what comes after. And if so, is that the landscape kind of speaking? Is it that desire to feel the outback or figure out what happens next?
Well, I think that's just a natural tendency of the genre. But
in the 60s, it was utopias
Well, the 60s is kind of the start of the dystopian aspect as well. But like kind of the golden age of science fiction in the 1950s, the immediate post-war years, there's this kind of teleological view of the future that technology would solve all of humanity's problems and everything was going to be great. We'd be eating food pills and, wearing Velcro slippers in space. And that kind of started to break down with the end of the space age. So I think there's kind of been a natural tendency towards dystopian futures.
I think it's been sort of pretty much equal for quite a while. I mean, some of the 19th century ones, K.V. Mackay's The Yellow Wave, A Romance of the Asiatic Invasion of Australia. Rata, The Coloured Conquest, William Lane, White or Yellow, A Story of the Race War of AD 1908. I mean,
there's a theme here.
Yeah, well, sorry about that. But if anybody who's read the Bulletin from that era knows that it was appalling in terms of its attitudes. And these are all dystopias of what's going to happen. But at the same time, having looked at some of these, you get Sir Julius Vogel, Anno Domini 2000, or Woman's Destiny. And so you've got the British Empire ruling the world with the Parliament being held in Melbourne. And the main character is the MP for Dunedin, New Zealand. And there's also the American president is a woman who has a teenage daughter but no husband. So it's an imperialist, feminist utopia, which is, it has a perfect logic. It's quite optimistic. that's just an example. There's other ones like Melbourne and Mars, My Mysterious Life on Two Planets, by Joseph Fraser, who was a phrenologist. He thought your psychology was based on the bumps of your head. And that was no personal wealth, no money transactions, 5 hours of work a day. Ooh, that sounds nice. Fountains of electricity supplying free power. Women and men are equal. The dominant philosophy is theism, and yet it's absolutely nothing about ecology. All wild beasts have been exterminated, including and also birds of prey, vermin and insects, and so the biosphere is humans, songbirds, fluffy animals, donkeys and goats. I mean, something like that, it's a utopia. It reads as completely daft. But I would say that utopias were running quite strong. The First World War was probably a key factor in that people suddenly realised that the future wasn't going to be as nice as they thought it would be, and that utopias have been declining since then. But I still think it's possible to have utopic thoughts, to consider how the world might be better. You could never get a perfect world, that would be too boring, but you could have these sort of messy utopias in which humans, tending to messiness anyway, in which there are notions about how we might live in a better way, in a different way. And I think it's very important to have these thoughts, because otherwise we'll succumb to despair at what is going on.
Doesn't sound very Australian, though, the whole idea of a utopia. I mean, the Australian sensibility is more, and to paraphrase, stuff's screwed. You know, it's that we have a cynical sort of view on the world and on people and on authority in particular. So the idea that we can live in a world in which everything is sweet is, I don't know, it just doesn't feel very Aussie to me.
But I think we also have that she'll be right, mate attitude. So, if the whole place is on fire and everyone's dying, we'll still be like, the beer's still cold. Yeah. So
we live in a dystopia, but it's all right.
It's all right. Who really cares? I think your question, though, about the influence of the outback on dystopia is interesting, because I would assume that that would be correct, that most dystopias would be dry, dusty places set in the outback, like, Chuck Song is pretty outbacky. But it seems like a lot of the things I've been reading lately are set in Melbourne. There's a lot of sort of urban-based dystopian writing going on. And I guess that's probably because most of us live in cities, I guess, and maybe that's why. But there's some really good city-based stuff, which I guess is also more international as well. Maybe is more sellable overseas. I don't know. Thoughts?
Well, of course, there's a very great novel from 1987, George Turner's The Sea in Summer, which is about Melbourne in the greenhouse era. And I look at it and I think, oh, yes, two classes, the sweet class and the swill class and high-rise buildings. And it's an alarming but rather believable book. And it won both a science fiction award and was shortlisted for the Commonwealth Writers Prize. And something like that has sort of slipped under the radar, but it would make an excellent film, and I think it should be made. That's like Melbourne dystopia, as we could be fast approaching.
Or there's something like, The Courier's New Bicycle, which maybe you've read.
Westwood.
A Melbourne-based dystopia. Again, was, much lauded when it came out, shortlisted for a lot of things, and then has kind of just vanished again. But also would make a great film, set in a future where everyone has lost their fertility, and fertility is something that's bartered and sold, any sort of gender difference is tried to be wiped out. It's a pretty great dystopia.
Fantastic. And deliberately set in a city as opposed to the
outback. Very urban.
Okay. Oh, interesting. And so just coming off that, we've got a couple of minutes left before we cut to audience questions. So at risk of trying to sort of condense the discussion, Australian sci-fi, does it exist?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. All right. There we go. I think we're done. We can go home. Yeah.
I speaking as someone who sells most of his books overseas, I think there is Australians doing well, not necessarily just based in Australia, but who are doing well overseas as well. And I think we have a lot to learn from the film industries and the game industry as well, video game industry, where you have a lot of Australians who are not necessarily bestsellers in Australia, but they are known overseas and they're representing Australia overseas. There's a video game that's just come out at the moment called Borderlands, the pre-sequel, and it's this shoot-em-up game. It's an American game, basically, but one of the developers... major centre of the development happened in Australia. And so there are all these Aussie voices in it, and it has such an Australian feel to it. And it was, you know, it's terrific because it was never set out, it was never designed as an Australian game, it has no Australian message to push or anything. It just happens to be Aussie, and it's fantastic.
I have nothing to add.
Yeah, I guess I subscribe to Greg Egan's perspective, which is that... there's really no such thing as Australian science fiction. There's just Australian writers writing science fiction.
Yep. All right, short and sweet. Okay, oh, fantastic. So with that, we might cut to audience questions. Does anyone happen to have a question? I believe Max is prepared to incentivise you with copies.
Oh, yeah, I am. I have books to give away.
Does that change anyone's mind?
My latest novel. I don't want you to think that I've like printed off 10,000 copies and I'm stuck with these books. Right? This is a best-selling novel. It's written to my contract that I get copies of editions every time they're printed. So, and then my agent sends me some, so I wind up with boxes and boxes. So free copies of Lexicon to the first...
To the first
few
question,
people
first
who
is,
ask a
oh, that's
question.
Changed things. Oh, that's changed things.
Yeah, there we go.
I think there's a lack of military science fiction in Australia. Do you agree? And if not, can you tell me who writes it? Because I'd love to read it.
Yeah, well, I'm not aware of any myself.
It's a huge area. It's very popular, and people who write it make a lot of money. But I think it's probably some of the people who are working in novelisations of games who are closest to that sort of thing. But yes, it, look, you know, if you can write it, excellent.
There's a niche.
Because there are some very famous, a lot of very famous sci-fi novels, American ones especially, I guess, that are military sci-fi. But yeah, I can't think of an Australian equivalent. No reason why there shouldn't be.
Watch this space. Yeah. And we've got one just here. Yeah.
Thank you. I was, as a non-Australian, I was wondering if, besides having a large yellow hole in the middle of Australia, you have very isolated cities. You could do an amazing... And there's very few other countries where you've got population in about six centres and then practically nothing between. You really could do something to build on that. That would be probably require an Australian to write it because... Nobody else has the same experience as that. I'm just wondering if you come across stuff that relates to the sort of isolated patches of people hanging around the edges of this possibly soon-to-be-flooded universe.
There was an awful lot of books in the 19th century which were, you would get to the centre of Australia and there would be this wonderful civilization. Of course, they'd be white. Or there's a bunch of mad scientists in the centre of Australia busy growing germs. I'm not making that up. There was The Germ Growers by Canon Robert Potter of St. Paul's Cathedral actually did write such a book, or an inland sea in which... And so there was this idea that the centre of Australia was this fantastic populated place, if only we could find it. And it's a sort of great wish that never was discovered.
Mm. That's exactly right, though. That is one of the really different things about Australia, that we have these towns of quite a lot of people, you know, 5,000-10,000 people that are a million miles from anywhere. And in the book that you have just earned yourself a copy of, sir, I have, it's set in Broken Hill, which is, you know, the more I researched this place, the more I was amazed by it because it's a million miles from anywhere. There's a massive hole in the middle of it where they've just dug all this crap up and chucked it in great mounds next to the town. And so in my novel, a character goes there basically as punishment. She's banished to this place because it is like a prison in a sense. It's so isolated. I grew up in country Gippsland, so not the same sort of isolation as Broken Hill, but that the feel you get from a small Australian town is pretty special. Uh, I I didn't really enjoy it all that much as a teenager. You kind of yearn to get out of there and go somewhere where something is happening, but it does have an amazing feel to it, and I was happy to go back to it for the novel.
I'm amazed there aren't more stories set in Canberra, where I grew up, which does
That's
have...
That's a weird place.
Yeah, which is a weird place, and it has a sort of undercurrent of weirdness. It feels haunted, basically, all
That's
the
like
time.
That's like someone's idea of a utopia, but you know there's something wrong.
Something's wrong somewhere if someone could just put their finger on it. So well,
Kim Westwood wrote a short story set in Canberra, Turning the Wheel. I reckon you'd love it.
I'm going to read that right now.
Well, Adelaide seems to have a disproportionate number of fantasy writers, and I can't help but speculate whether it's, I don't know, to fill the void. But I don't want to get, but it's so safe and comfortable that, you have to invent these fantastical other worlds. There's not some sort of city bashing, but it does then beg the question. Okay, thank you. And we have one down here before. Yeah.
So my question would be around, considering I'm really familiar with the work of Cory Doctorow, and his approach to actually how we got into the whole sci-fi fantasy setting by starting to work with creative license, and his view about the fact that the worst enemy of any authors is obscurity. Mm. So not being Australian, being here, I actually heard about three of you tonight by being here. And so do you consider it is actually a problem that the Australian market is small, and would you consider at one point trying the creative license of making your work available for free and then trying to actually get yourself known better and everything else that implies?
Yeah, well, look, the idea about giving your work away for free because you really just want people to know who you are, there's a lot of merit to it. And I give away my short stories usually. I just put them on my website. And if anyone wants to print them for their community newspaper or whatever they're doing anywhere in the world, they can do that. I haven't gone to the extent that Corey has, where he puts his whole novels out there and says, do what you will with them. It's been very successful for him. And it's a brave thing to do for any author, but it's worked well for him. The thing about being Australian, this is a little bit industry talk maybe for this panel, but just my experience is it's often hard for Australian writers because they get published in Australia first. It's a small market, so it's not enough to really sustain them financially as they write the next book. And then when they look to sell the rights overseas, it's less interesting to a publisher in America or wherever, because they look back and they say, well, this is not a new book. This was published in Australia and it sold 1,000 copies or 500 copies or whatever it did. So, we'd rather be a bit more speculative and take a chance on something that may be a mega seller. So it's hard to break out of Australia, I feel. It's almost easier to start over there and then come back here than it is to go the other way.
Well, the trouble, what also can happen, and this happened with George Turner's The Sea in Summer, was that he sold to Faber in the UK, but he was distributed here by an Australian subsidiary. And because, and this has happened again and again, in that a book is published overseas and the local subsidiary book doesn't really have a stake in it. They're not as interested in pushing it. So either you sell world rights, and I mean, I've had the experience of trying to on-sell something that has sold in Australia, and they say, oh, well, Australia's most of your market, and that market is gone because you've sold the Australian rights. I mean, this is the big problem in Australian writing, of trying to get an international feel, and it's very hard to break out of this attitude. And I wish that there would, and it's really not getting any better.
I would absolutely give my stuff away for free, no worries. But I don't think the problem is people aren't going, oh, I really like that writer, but I'm not prepared to pay that money. No one's heard of me and no one cares. So I could put all my stuff out there for free, but no one's going to see it. I don't know how you would go about marketing your free stuff to the rest of the world in among all the other masses of free stuff and 99-cent stuff there is out there.
That's the thing, isn't it? Because it's actually not free. I mean, it costs the reader in time to read a free book, so the price is not necessarily the issue.
Mm. Yeah, which is the challenge with Amazon, sifting through stuff looking for nuggets of gold. Okay, great. Thank you. And we had one here. Yeah.
Ooh. Hi. I was interested in a comment that you made about high school teachers. How do you think science fiction can be used in schools on the Australian curriculum with the new Auswahl English that's come out? How would you recommend that high school teachers use it in their classroom?
I think the high school teachers should set all our books on the high school curriculum.
It's impossible to top that answer.
Hard to argue with that one.
Yeah.
I guess, particularly as we were talking about dystopia and utopia, the idea of getting kids to explore what kind of a future they'd like to have, where they think we're heading with decisions that we're making now, is that where they want to go? If they have an idea of how they'd like the future to be, what decisions do we need to make now to get us there? And that's the sort of stuff that science fiction generally explores.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, and kids, teenagers are interested in this stuff, you know, and apocalypses.
Yeah.
So, you know,
yeah.
The whole range is there.
Instead of trying to impose that sort of realist type of, you know, have to be interested in the quotidian every day. You know,
I'm not actually sure what's on the book list now as opposed to 20 years ago when I went through. But, I read a lot of novels set in the English countryside from memory. Maybe it was just one novel that I hated so much. It feels like that was my entire schooling.
Next book, Dystopia in the English Countryside.
Right,
Fabulous. And we have one more up the back.
Thanks. In terms of military science fiction, John Birmingham's World War trilogy.
Oh, of course.
Yes. Oh, yes. Fantastic. Yeah. Forgot about that.
Thank you. for that, man.
Do you think that, in fact, science fiction is the literature of the 20th and 21st century, so that's why so-called literary writers are now trying to grapple with the concept of writing something interesting for a change?
Well, we're living in an age where technology is advancing so rapidly that it seems like the fantastical is going to become the possible, you know, if not tomorrow, then the day after. So it probably does open more doors. And you think, well, this idea that would have been far-fetched and would have consigned my story to niche science fiction readers is now something that I can translate plausibly to just your typical reader. It just becomes a good story that has this element in it. So, yeah, technology has just become part of our lives. And I think the challenge for a science fiction writer is to take the technology and to make it personal, to think about how it affects people. I often have, you know, an idea, you know, this may be happening in the world, or you look at your New Scientist magazine and there's been this discovery. And the challenge is to, okay, take that and think, who is it going to affect and how? You know, which people does it put into what situation, and what choices does it force upon them? What instability does it bring to their lives? You know, these sorts of things become good stories.
Our lives have changed unimaginably over in the 20th century, and they can only get stranger and wilder in the 21st century. So I do think we have a duty to write about what might be happening and what is likely to affect people. And apart from anything else, it's really interesting exploring the notions of technology and how the influence it has on people. So you stretch your brain when you're writing about these things.
And interestingly, as more mainstream writers discover the utility of science fiction tropes, science fiction writers find it harder and harder to grapple with ideas about the future because it's just so radically contingent now that it's difficult to imagine what the world will look like in 30 years, whereas 30 years ago it was a little bit easier. So a writer like William Gibson is now basically writing novels that are set in the present. So I think that's an interesting phenomenon as well, that it gets... The extropian transhumanist field, the so-called singularity, it's almost impossible to imagine what something like that might look like.
I mean, you take a risk. You always take a risk of getting things wrong, but doesn't mean you shouldn't. You shouldn't do it just because technology is moving so fast. It's the ideas that are coming from you in all directions, and it's you make a story of them, and that in that way you illuminate our current condition by looking into the future.
And it's not really just technology either. It feels like culture is changing and social ideas. I mean, maybe it's always been like this. Certainly there were revolutions in the 60s and all this sort of stuff as well. But yeah, it feels like it is hard to keep up with the world. If you write near future, it becomes the present really quick.
It's interesting how it, just as a side note, it's interesting how the focus has shifted away from space as the sort of the key technology and now become, and computing was the one that people didn't so much see coming, and yet that one has been the one to totally transform our lives, you know, to the point we have supercomputers almost in our pockets, you know. So it's interesting that people, you know, sci-fi writers are attempting to predict these futures, some of which come to pass and others which are perhaps indefinitely delayed. That wasn't really a question so much as a comment. I've broken the golden rule.
Yeah. I don't think anybody predicted the effect of the personal computers and what that would do to people's lives. And I don't even think the internet was particularly noted as an important force, but it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more of a comment, really. thank you. Anyone else got one last question? We're going to have to battle it out down here. We've got one up the back, sorry. Okay.
Is there a association for science fiction and fantasy writers in Australia on or off the internet where we can find you all?
Come on, Lucy, this is yours.
it's a funny area. There's an Association of Australian Horror Writers. There's romance writers. There's crime writers. There's women crime writers. But there's not really an association of Australian writers, but there is a very healthy convention scene. Mm. So generally, as with conventions like Continuum or what's some of the others?
Conflux.
Conflux is a Canberra-based one.
Yeah.
SwanCon in Perth, of course.
There is, though, every year some very brave bloggers take on the task of interviewing every Australian working in speculative fiction that they can think of. So there's a speculative fiction snapshot. If you do a search for that on the internet, you'll come up with hundreds of people and interviews with them about what they're doing. And,
Pretty interesting. Sorry. Yeah, I was just going to say there are lots of informal writing groups in speculative fiction. I don't know how you find them, but they're there. If you Google hard,
Kat might have an idea.
Fantastic. And we might have time for one last question. Okay. It's down to one of you two. All right, who's it going to be? All right. That chivalry.
Okay, first of all, to the English gentleman asked about distance around Australia, and Sean McCallum's Souls in the Great Machine really tackles that sort of post-apocalyptic sort of water levels rising. But what I wanted to ask was, does the genre of science fiction hurt our readership? Like, does having the label of science fiction for a piece of work, like, you know, you were mentioning Time Traveler's Wife, it wasn't marketed as science fiction, but it was, and it got to a wider audience. You know, people I know who would never read science fiction had read that book, and then that got them into thinking about other things. So, does genre hurt us as writers?
I know my publisher thought it would, and marketed my book as literary fiction, not as a genre fiction. But I'm not sure if that opinion's backed up by fact or not.
Well, no,
just marketed it as fiction.
It can, if you have marketed as science fiction, it will reach a targeted audience. But if you want a wider audience, and this is an issue of the small audiences in Australia, then you try as widely as you can. And these days, if you're a fan of Margaret Atwood, for instance, she goes from crime fiction to science fiction to anything that she wants to. So I do think the labels are breaking down a bit. But a comment about Karen Joy Fowler, who was speaking at the Wheeler Centre not so long ago, that same night she spoke at the Wheeler Centre, she discovered she'd been shortlisted for the Booker. And a comment was made to her, well, they've finally forgiven you for writing science fiction.
Yeah, look, it's a tough one, and I often have the question as well whether to market a book as sci-fi or not when it's a book that technically is science fiction but is not blatantly so. So, yeah, I don't know what the answer is. You, if you if you push a book very hard as sci-fi, then, yeah, as Lucy says, you do tend to be read by all the people who read all the science fiction, whereas if you shotgun it more widely, then, you know, maybe you get some penetration and maybe you don't. So I don't know. I guess it's a marketing exercise, and it's really up to the people who figure out how to sell books rather than the people who try to write them. So I don't know if there's a good answer for it.
Thanks. The genre that dare not speak its name. All right, and that brings us to our conclusion. So please put your hands together to thank our excellent panel.